We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning. He is off enjoying the
holiday.
He's
enjoying the holiday. Yeah.
Having a break. Uh-huh. We give him one per year where he, you know, gets it. We give it to him willingly. All right. So still plenty to cover. And we're going to be doing we'll start out with local here, but we're going to be doing right after that your top 10 list of financial stories that were undercovered, misrepresented, what?
Underreported.
Underreported. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. First off, I want to talk just one local item. I want to talk about, I want to congratulate the Seattle City Council for passing a plastic grocery bag ban. It had been introduced to the council a couple of weeks ago, and they discussed it and took testimony and decided to pass a ban on the single-use plastic grocery bags that folks use to bag up their groceries and take items home from the store. It doesn't include bags for bulk food items or vegetables or meat or other things you get at the grocery store. Doesn't include dry cleaning bags. And customers will be charged. Customers who don't bring their bags to the store and who use paper bags will be charged 5 cents a bag, so that the retailers can recoup the cost of providing a bag. Hopefully, this will make people's grocery prices a little more reasonable. It looks to me like this ban, unlike the ban that was proposed a couple of years ago, this ban will actually not be challenged by the plastic bag industry.
All right. So let's dive into your top 10 financial stories.
Yeah, the big underreported financial stories of the year. At the top of my list, of course, the one financial story that was overreported this year was the European debt crisis. However, nobody, either here or in Europe, talked about how the European debt crisis itself was largely manufactured by investors to punish the European Central Bank and the European Union for not doing things the way that the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. and the Treasury did back in 2008. If you remember back in 2008, the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury were really quick to bail out the big banks and big financial companies. And the Federal Reserve in particular made it so easy for banks to borrow money essentially interest-free that even European banks and banks in other parts of the world lined up and took loans from essentially interest-free loans from the U.S. Federal Reserve. And the European Union hasn't been doing that. They've been insisting instead on austerity measures on these nations with sovereign debt. They've been insisting that these nations pay off their debts and that European banks also come into line with new regulations for raising capital in order to cover their own risks and their own loans.
After
a full year of being threatened by investors with the collapse of Greece and the potential collapse of Spain and Italy, it took until early December for the European Central Bank to finally announce, well, okay, we're going to offer very low interest rate loans to European banks. So in the end, investors won. But it was a crisis that was largely manufactured, I think. Sure, Greece was in trouble. They had borrowed way too much money. But you can't say the same about Spain and Italy. They had their finances under control, and it was only when investors started ditching their bonds and saying, you know, oh, we're afraid there's horrible risk here. We're going to sell all of our European debt holdings, and interest rates went sky high for those countries, that they really started to get into trouble. And so the European debt crisis really was manufactured by investors. Mm. So that never really made the news.
And in the end, don't the investors always win?
Well, yes, and that's the reason why they were pushing for this. Because if a country like Greece can default on its loans, then the investors lose. They lose, you know, however much the bonds become worth. You know, the original agreement that was struck between the European Union and Greece was that investors would have to take a certain loss. Private investors would have to take a certain loss on their Greek government bonds. And boy, that didn't help. They immediately said, okay, well, if Greece can default, essentially what investors assumed was a default, then what happens to our other European bonds? And they started dumping European debt like crazy. So, yes, indeed. In this case, you're right. Investors do eventually win.
All right. What do you have for number two?
For number two is a story that was never talked about in the press and is never talked about in the press because I think most people never really understand it, even financial reporters, and that's the continuing problems in the bond market. Now, think for a minute about the folks who are retiring. We've got a large population of baby boomers who are heading into retirement, and a lot of them are putting their money because stock funds haven't been doing very well in the last 3 years. A lot of them are putting all of their money into bond funds. If you look at mutual funds, you'll see that stock funds are returning about 1 to 3% a year. That's a good stock fund. And bond funds are seeing returns of much higher than that, 7 to 10% in the case of some of the higher risk, high yield funds. But you have to be asking, and I hope you're asking the same way I am, where the heck is all that money going, given that nobody can get a loan these days? You know, bonds are essentially loans. They're issued by governments, U.S. Treasuries, for example, who are taking out loans. But U.S. Treasuries are limited. You know, the deficit has a limit. It can't continually expand to fit the high demand for bonds. You know, and corporations can issue bonds, but they haven't been doing a lot of expanding, and a lot of corporations have money that they're just sitting on. They have cash they're just sitting on, and they don't really need more cash. They can't be issuing that many bonds. So I kind of scratched my head and I asked myself, well, you know, Where's all that money going? Money that's getting poured into bond funds. So what I did is I went and I looked at one of the largest bond index funds in the United States. It's a fund that's always highly talked of, that's recommended when you read financial magazines. And I thought, okay, if I look at that bond fund and see what its holdings are, maybe I'll get an idea of what the entire bond market looks like, because it's a fund that is meant to be an index fund. It tracks the entire bond market. So I looked at the composition of what was in that that bond fund, and what I found, it says, you know, in the materials, kind of in the overview of what's in the fund, it said that 70% of it is agency debt, meaning U.S. government debt, essentially. Well, I looked at that and I saw that really U.S. Treasuries in that fund make up about 35.6%. Essentially treasuries issued to fund the federal deficit. But the other 34.4% of that government agency debt is mortgage bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, if you include with that 34.4%, the 7.5% that is other financial company debt, which is, you know, bonds issued by big banks, insurance companies, and other financial companies, then a good 42% of the bonds in this bond fund are related to the housing market. And I'm guessing because a lot of banks have not been forced to take write-downs and write off what are essentially worthless mortgage bonds, that's probably true at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're still reporting continually each quarter, reporting losses and essentially resisting as long as they can writing off what is worthless debt. That's still an enormous part of the market, these mortgage bonds that no one really knows what their value is, because none of the big banks will come clean on what's in those mortgage bonds and what the repayment schedule is and if people can repay them. And then looking at the rest of the fund, the other 30% of bonds in that fund, only 13% are what you might call bonds from the real economy. So things like industry, retail sector, communications, energy, transportation, technology companies, et cetera. Only 13%. So that really shows you that companies are not the ones that are issuing the debt, that are issuing the bonds that people are owning when they pour their money into these bond funds. The 10 to 15% or so are things like foreign sovereign debt, municipal bonds, money market funds, that sort of thing. But I found that really interesting that a good 40% or more, about 42% of what's in a bond index fund is mortgage debt, essentially. And so people don't realize that there are still these problems in the bond market, even though they're pouring their retirement savings and they're taking money out of what they think are low performing stock funds and pouring it into these higher returning bond funds. And I think there's still, I think that a lot of companies are still lying, banks in particular, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are still lying about the value and the rate of return on those bonds. And I think people are going to be surprised that eventually there's going to be some kind of collapse in the bond market. Hmm. So number three on the list is nearly half of Americans are either poor or near poor. That was from census data that was released this year. About 48% of the U.S. population makes barely 200% of the poverty level. Now, the poverty level, which 49 million people are at or below the poverty level, that's $22,314 a year for a family of four, which is largely a joke. No family of four can live on that. Low income in this case is $44,405 per year for a family of four. Again, that's an extreme struggle to make it on that. That's 97.3 million people total. The two total, again, 48% of the population. Included in those statistics, which were never really broadly reported, is that one in four Americans need emergency food assistance. 57% of children in the U.S. are in a poor or low-income family. That's a majority of the children in the United States. And that 62% of low-income families spent more than one-third of their earnings on housing and another 20% on child care costs. So that doesn't leave a whole lot left for things like food, clothing, school clothes, transportation, all the other things that you need money for. Number four on my list this year of underreported economic stories is the average tax rate paid by large U.S. corporations. Now, large U.S. corporations are always complaining, well, we have high taxes here in the United States. The average tax rate for corporations is 35%. Well, 35% is the aspirational tax rate for large U.S. corporations. The actual rate paid by large corporations, according to the Citizens for Tax Justice, is 18.5%, a little more than half the aspirational rate. Only one quarter of the corporations studied paid more than 30%. Another one quarter paid less than 10%. And of that group, about 30 companies paid no taxes at all, in spite of the fact that many, if not most of them, made a profit last year. So that was a big story that was almost not reported almost nowhere.
And those are some big name companies too. That
some big name companies. Some of them are local. Boeing, for example, it has so many tax incentives from tax breaks and incentives from the U.S. government that it essentially pays no federal tax at all. And it's had some very profitable years. PACCAR is another one they've been able to outsource their production to foreign countries, so that of course they make lots of money in those foreign countries, but they don't bring that money home, so it's not taxed in the United States. Microsoft does this nice little trick where they put a bunch of their order centers in other parts of the world, so that if you call up to order a product or you go online to order a product, it gets the order gets initiated from another country. Therefore, they claim that their revenue is also foreign income. So they don't pay tax on a lot of what is essentially U.S. income.
All right.
So number five on the list, the Congressional Budget Office released a study this year that was sort of reported, but it came and went in a very, very short time frame. It was sort of on the radar and then gone almost immediately. A Congressional Budget Office study on income disparity in the United States. It showed that the richest 1% of households, their income increased 275% over the last 3 years. Now, the last 3 years includes the economic downturn from 2008 through 2011. And the richest 1%, they made out like bandits in that time period when the rest of us really didn't. The upper 20%, Now, we moan quite a bit about the top 1%, but the upper 20%, they took home, altogether took home 53% of all after-tax income. That's more than the other 80% of the United States population put together. So sometimes people say, well, I'm in the upper 20%, and it's not all that much money. But you know what? All told, people in the upper 20% have too much money, essentially. Now, the poorest 20% of the U.S. population only took home 5% of after-tax income. And that shows you maybe that should be a little clue to people in the media and the elites in this country as to why people are in the streets saying we are the 99%.
I think they have a pretty good idea why people are in the streets.
I think you're right. They probably do. They just don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Number six on the list is the racial composition of poverty in the United States. Now, the Census Bureau also released some statistics this year about who makes up the poor in the United States. Now, when we always hear talk, you know, about how affirmative action is not necessary anymore, you know, the United States is the country where you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, everyone has an equal chance to become a millionaire, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the facts don't bear that out. In the Census Bureau's poverty statistics, it shows that the proportion of African Americans who are below the poverty level is 27%. For Hispanics, it's 26%. For whites, it's 9.9%. So I think there may be a very, very good argument for reviving affirmative action, and that this is one of them. But of course, this is not something that got reported at all in the media. But also buried in those statistics was another interesting little item. Median annual income for a male full-time worker in 2010. Now, the median income, for folks who don't remember, is the income that's at the very middle of the range between the person paid the highest rate and the person's paid the lowest rate in the United States. It's the very middle of the range. The median annual income for a male full-time worker in 2010 was $47,715, just barely above that low-income line. In 1973, can you guess what it was?
I'll guess that it was $50,000.
You're pretty close. It was $49,065. It was higher in 1973 than it was in 2010. So essentially, what we have here is a lost generation. You know, this myth that we're always continually moving forward, that Americans are only getting richer, et cetera, et cetera. I think the numbers show otherwise.
All right. What do you got next? Mortgage?
Number seven on the list is, it is about mortgages. We just talked about what a lot of the bond market is made up of, and it's a surprisingly large amount of the bond market is made up of mortgage debt. And you would think over the last 3 years that some of that mortgage debt would have gotten washed out of the system, written off, and that the bond market would have much less of it than it did. And, you know, and I think if you looked 3 years ago at what proportion in bond funds was made up of mortgage debt, it probably would have been higher than 42%. In August, the FBI issued a report. They have a task force that looks into mortgage fraud each year. And their task force issued a report that said that mortgage fraud is still widespread in the United States. It means that in the year 2010 and 2011, that more than $10 billion in fraudulent loans were made. So banks and other companies are still continuing to make these adjustable rate mortgages with low teaser rates that people can't afford. And they also found that many of the loans that were made with falsified documents so that people who really didn't qualify for the loan could qualify to get a loan to buy a house. They also included inflated appraisals. So a lot of the time they would pay a buddy to go out and jack up the price of the house so that people would end up having to borrow much more in mortgage debt than they really needed in order to buy the property. And that a lot of people were being talked into buying investment rental properties who really couldn't afford to and really shouldn't probably buy houses in that market. In those particular markets, and that the fraud was worse in the parts of the country that had gone through the worst downturns in the housing market, places like California, Florida, Nevada, and so forth. Also, as part of this whole mortgage problem, the Associated Press reported this year that mortgage companies were continuing to do robo-signing. I know that last year that was one of the big economic news stories of the year, was that these companies that process mortgage documents were essentially signing, you know, the name, were essentially just signing whoever's name to the documents and processing them without any kind of a review of the paperwork at all. Well, the AP reported this year that mortgage robo-signing is continuing. It's continuing to be done on sale documents like title transfers, for example. And that brings up the issue of, okay, if you've got a title transfer that's been signed by somebody who knows who it was never reviewed, you can't find that person. That person maybe never worked at that bank, or maybe they did work at that bank, but they never saw your documents. It might call into question who actually owns the property you just bought. And that could, again, be another huge scandal going down the road here in the next few years.
So what was the organization that was in charge, or organizations besides the FBI, that was in charge of following up on that back last year in terms of the robo-signing and sort of government oversight beyond the FBI?
Well, that's a good question. You can ask, is there much government oversight over any of this stuff? And that's another story. You know, the fact that government agencies are not following through. A lot of these companies that have been caught robo-signing, they paid a small settlement in 2010, saying, "Oh, we're sorry, we did this. Here's some money. Make it go away." And essentially, it did for them. But they're continuing to do the same things that they were. Formerly, I believe they were caught robo-signing documents for refinances initially and for second mortgages. This time around, they're saying on initial sale documents like the transfer of a title, they're robo-signing those, and that can be really problematic.
Let's keep moving on.
So number eight on the list of economic stories this year was take-home pay. In 2010. So we talked a little bit about how much after-tax income the richest of Americans have versus the poorest. But we didn't talk about who overall gets to take home what amount of pay in the U.S., corporations versus small businesses versus employees versus investors. And those numbers are a little bit shocking, too. Corporate profits in 2010 accounted for 14% of national income, and that's the highest percentage ever, which just shows, yes, corporate profits are booming, but at the expense of who? Small businesses had their lowest ever percentage of take-home pay. It was 8.3% for small business owners. Now, employees, the folks who have almost always every year been above 50% of the take-home pay, this year, or in 2010, their take-home pay was 49.9%, just below the 50% level. And, of course, that leaves another 28.4%, and you might ask, who took that home? The answer to that is investors, the folks who don't work for a living, who largely speculate on the movements in the money in the financial markets, who own company stock, who own bonds, the folks, in other words, who along with major corporations have made out big in this downturn.
And investors, in just a sense of numbers, your guess for how many investors we're talking about, either percentage-wise?
Who knows? Some of those investors are mom-and-pop people who have a little bit of money in a 401k. Some, you know, they put $1,000 in an IRA every year, or maybe $500 in an IRA every year. Some of them are people who put a little cash in a money market fund, or even just some money in your savings account at the bank to earn a little bit of interest. The folks who really have a say in the market are the big hedge funds and the big pension funds, the folks who manage money for clients who own hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in investments. Those are the folks I mean when I say investors. I don't mean mom and pop who got 3% on a stock fund in their 401k or their IRA. I'm talking about the folks who literally make hundreds of millions of dollars a year, manage, you know, because they have billions invested, and they have never had to work a day in their lives.
All right. Number nine.
Number nine is the failure of the Chrysler bailout. Now, when Chrysler was bailed out, the U.S. Treasury, Timothy Geithner, was very quick to say, U.S. taxpayers will make money off of this deal. You know, here we are, we're gonna give money to Chrysler, we're gonna bail them out, but Chrysler has to pay us back, and we will almost certainly make money off of it. Well, in fact, the Treasury sold its last Chrysler stock in July, and overall, the taxpayers didn't make money off the deal. There was a $1.3 billion loss overall, and of course that came out of taxpayers' pockets. Now, the other argument for doing the Chrysler bailout was that it would save a U.S. car manufacturer, and a lot of people were gung-ho for that. Yes, let's save a U.S. employer. You know, they have workers here in the United States. It's a U.S. company made in the USA, rah, rah. Well, the problem with that is that the Chrysler bailout didn't save a U.S. automaker. Chrysler is now majority owned by Fiat, which is an Italian company. And Fiat announced when they took over Chrysler that they were going to merge the two companies, essentially make Chrysler a part of Fiat, and that, yes, indeed, some folks in the U.S. might lose their jobs as a result. So no, it didn't save a U.S. automaker, and no, Chryslers will not be made in the USA necessarily. Now, Chrysler, I want to point out that Chrysler would have been bought out by another car company even if the bailout had never happened. If Chrysler had been allowed to go into bankruptcy, surely another company probably would have stepped in and said, okay, we'll take those assets indeed, and that's what Fiat did anyway, even with the bailout. Now, the difference is that without the bailout, Chrysler shareholders and bondholders, well, in particular, Chrysler bondholders, would have taken something of a loss, would have taken that $1.3 billion loss. Instead, with the bailout, it was taxpayers that took the $1.3 billion loss. And that's always true when a bailout happens. What the U.S. government is essentially doing is nationalizing the loss.
And investors win again.
And investors win yet again.
All right. Number 10.
The final item on my list is we know that corporations had windfall profits this year and last year. And this is in spite of record unemployment. And, of course, it raises the question, what did corporations do with all of that cash? Well, in June, the New York Times had an article that they printed, and essentially nobody else picked it up. It was entitled, Employers Spend on Equipment Rather Than Hiring. And I just want to point out that, yes, indeed, equipment is a lot cheaper for corporations to buy, and they've been going on an equipment and software spending binge in the last couple of years. Some of the reasons why equipment is cheaper is because most of the equipment that corporations buy is made abroad by people who don't make the same amount of money you and I do when we have a job here in the United States. Plus, you know, corporations get a nice tax write-off from the U.S. government for buying equipment. And all told, equipment and software prices are down 2.4% in the last couple of years, while labor costs have increased 6.7% in that time frame, largely because of skyrocketing healthcare costs. Now, that's no surprise. Hiring in the last 2 years has been up slightly, just about 2%, but equipment and software purchases have been up 26% in the two-year time frame. So when you see those windfall corporate profits and you think, oh, jobs, there are going to be more jobs, not necessarily. and not necessarily here in the United States. Maybe some equipment manufacturer in East Asia might be able to hire some people if you want to go there, but don't count on there being more jobs here.
Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State, and where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found online at www.eatthestate.org.